Blog Talk Radio.
Your Philadelphia Eagles, put your hands up. evening and welcome to the 427th continuous program of Fighting Words News Network, the flagship program, Fighting Words. Fighting Words is brought to you each and every week in grateful appreciation of the men and women of the United States Armed Forces, men and women of Police and Fire Services, by Dr. Kathleen Carroll, a board-certified psychiatrist in private practice since 2003. Dr. Carroll previously was Director of Inpatient Services at the Bay Pines VA Hospital and at the Bay Pines VA Medical Center. Dr. Carroll specializes in the treatment of children ages 6 and older and the treatment of adults. In other words, from the womb to the tomb. Dr. Carroll is also an all-time triathlete. And if you're having a problem breaking through to any kind of sports problem or any kind of sports wall, Dr. Carroll can help you. She's at Bloomingdale Psychiatric Associates, 336 East Bloomingdale Avenue, Brandon, Florida, area code 813-689-2466. Well, guys, we had had another great week. Before I go any further, I gotta pass the old chest. Casey's boys came through again. Ty had three touchdowns, 12 tackles, and 15 assists. Brady had two touchdowns, 7 tackles, 9 assists. And little Caden, my 5-year-old grandson, actually had his first 4-yard run for a touchdown, and he had four tackles and 6 assists. So I want to send a big shout-out to those boys. They did their grandfather proud, and we're really proud of them. So we're joined tonight by one of the newest members of the Fighting Words News Network, Dr. Ron Repesi. How you doing, Ron?
I'm doing great, Frank. Good to be here.
Good. Well, Ty, what do you think about this week's results?
Well, I know the results of our opening musical segment were quite atrocious, if we're speaking of those results.
I wanted to address that also, but go ahead.
Yeah, but you figured for the three Philadelphia Eagles fans still remaining in the audience in radio sphere somewhere that actually heard the good news about your grandchildren.
Well, this is also, you remember as we were going off last week, that was the big question that Dr. Chris had. So in honor of Dr. Chris.
Oh, that's right. That's
we played
right.
The
right.
We played the fight song. And on the 10th, you know, the Flyers start. In fact, if you guys are in the area, Tom LaMaine told me that he'll get passes for you for a couple of games this year.
Oh, that would be awesome. That would be outstanding. And in spite of the Philadelphia Eagles tribute, if we want to call it that, being as they're coming off another one-sided loss, I like to say we do have a great fight card tonight on HBO. Tavoris Cloud, who was last seen losing his title to Bernard Hopkins, the ageless one, is fighting the new superstar of the light heavyweight division, Adonis Superman Stevenson, the guy who's coming off the one-punch first-round knockout over Chad Dawson. So there's a lot of anticipation to that fight. A lot of people expect some fireworks for however long that fight might last, as well as our good friend Julio Cesar Chavez Jr. fighting tonight against Brian Vera. But there's been significant issues regarding the weight. The weight for that fight was not determined until Wednesday. And subsequently, the weight was set at the weight that Chavez weighed on Tuesday. Monday and Tuesday, Chavez weighed 173. He said he'd try his best to get as close to 168 as he can. Remember, this fight was initially made at a catchweight of 163, then 165, then 168. As of Tuesday, it was 173. I spoke to Zito Tuesday. Zito said, watch, they set the weight at 173. Sure enough, Wednesday, Arum sets the weight limit at 173.
Yeah.
You guys don't mind if I have a quick soapbox on that, do you? I have a very, very extreme problem with that. It's getting ridiculous the way guys weigh in, or they sign a contract to weigh in at this weight. They come, and even before the fight, you know they're weighing at this weight, so they have to lose 4 pounds in a week. In less than a week. These guys have to, you know, go hard and do extreme things to lose weight, and then they don't make the weight. So now they're paying. I mean, I understand that they're paying a guy, you know, maybe a couple $100,000. On the big fight scale, they're paying him a couple $100,000. But at the same time, now this guy's going in fighting a guy almost 20 pounds heavier than him, and then you get to the point. Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's dangerous.
Yeah,
that's
dangerous.
To be honest, when it comes to when it comes to, you know, hand skills, that's dangerous. And then we have guys, you know, I mean, this situation with Bob Arum and Julio Cesar Chavez, to where you get to determine what weight you're going to be almost before the fight? I mean, the fight's going to be at this weight. What kind of contract did they sign in the beginning? That's what I'm wondering.
Apparently liquid one.
Yeah, apparently a very, very liquid one. Lucid one. I mean, it doesn't make sense. I mean, I don't know what Brian Rivera's camp is thinking.
They're thinking they're going to get a check.
They're thinking big money. If he comes in heavier, we're going to get him for more money. But at the same time, oh, man, that's just – it's getting ridiculous with that. Guys, if you sign a contract for this, they should have a clause to where you don't weigh in at least 10 pounds overweight. I mean, I would say at least 6 to 7, but
Is the opposing fighter is typically always going to want to still have that fight, especially if he's it only happens this way if it's the A side. The B side fighter is going to want to have that fight because it's going to be typically for him a career high payday, which it is for, you know, Brian Vera, at least one of his, you know, upper echelon paydays, if not a career high payday. It's a good chance to step up in the rankings, marketability. So, and plus, he's just spent so much money on training expenses as well. So, for him, it behooves him to still take the chance, in a sense. Plus, that's a guy who's confident and believes in himself anyway. That's why he's a fighter. So, it, you know, it becomes a dual-edged sword. And again, Zito, on the opposite end of the spectrum, there was a MMA fighter in Brazil, nicknamed Feijão, last name Souza, who just died of a stroke trying to cut to make weight the last day before the weigh-ins. So, you know, that's what's going on with this situation.
Hey guys,
how you doing?
There we go. Here's
how you doing, guys.
Chris.
Hey, I was listening to you. What you said has been going on forever. If it's a non-title bout, these guys come in overweight. They don't. They do it all the time, and most of the time they're heavily fined.
Yep.
Was there any announcement as to how much the fine would be against Chavez?
Well, I don't know that there was a fine because the weight limit, again, it was initially set at 163, but then it got moved to 165, then 168. And Arum said he hadn't determined the final weight limit as of Tuesday of this week with the fight being tonight. And then Chavez said Monday that he weighed 173. Wednesday, Arum set the weight limit at 173. Chavez comes in 172.4. So technically he made weight because they just kept changing the weight.
You.
They changed the weight to accommodate Chavez.
Bob Arum moved the weight.
Arum, he gives away snowballs in Alaska. He made me the toughest businessman in boxing, you know? I mean, he's tough, man. There's a dollar involved, he's going to have his hands on it, and nobody's going to get it out of his hands. He's tough. I had some experience with him when Frankie Fletcher was fighting. He is terrible. Yeah, when Frankie was fighting, man, he got Frankie, but good. And then Frankie said, "You're not going to pay me if I don't fight Cipriani." He goes, "No, I'm not going to give you a nickel." He said, "Well, we're going to get $100,000 for fighting Cipriani." And he said, "Well, I'm not giving you $100,000. I'm giving you a shot to fight Hagler at $500,000. That's it.
Wow.
You fight Cipriani, you take a chance." He lost to Cipriani in a decision. They never gave him the Hagler fight, and Frankie just was a disaster after that. He was a disaster. That was his big chance, his big money. And by the way, he was scared to death of Hagler. He had no confidence against Hagler. Tough as he was.
Fredo Cipriani was a pretty good fighter.
He was a damn good fighter.
Fredo Cipriani, yeah.
But Frankie didn't have any, he never talk cocky about fighting Hagler, I can tell you that. I mean, he was a tough guy, but boy, Hagler had them all He had him in the pocket like Tiger Woods had those guys for a while. You know what I mean? Like Tyson had him for a while.
Yeah.
You know? But that doesn't happen too often. But Aram is he's brutal. I mean, he's going to change things around. Now, who's he fighting? Who's Chavez fighting?
He's fighting Brian Vera.
Brian Vera.
And Vera's coming off two pretty big victories. He just stopped. What's the former Zito? We just watched it. He just knocked him out. So it was the former junior middleweight title titleist that I liked a lot with the southpaw, real good jab. Zizrzuk.
Okay.
He just stopped Zizrzuk. He had just got a win over Sergio Moore, a stoppage over him. So he's kind of he's on like a three or four fight winning streak. So.
No, Vera's not naturally a 160-pounder. I mean, to be honest, at that, he's more on the 154 side of things, and they're making him move up to, 173?
Well, you know, he fought Sergio Moore at 160, and he beat him using his girth. So he had fought his last couple fights at 160. But no, he wouldn't be a big middleweight, but, yeah, he's definitely moving up, obviously, at 173. That makes his fight really a light heavyweight fight.
Yeah, it's 2 pounds under light heavyweight.
Well, it's 2 pounds under the light heavyweight limit.
He's going to have trouble. Yeah. He's going to have trouble with Chavez at that weight.
Yeah, stylistically, Brian Vera is not known as a slickster. He's a lunch bell guy. He comes at you and tries to grind you down. And, you know, he's in a sense, he's tailor-made for Chavez. If Chavez was extremely lazy in camp, he could get out and hustle. But, the size is an issue.
And Brian Vera, he'll be quicker than Chavez, and he'll be straighter than Chavez. He'll throw his punches straighter, but Chavez, I mean, at that size, when he gets unlazy, he'll walk through that and he'll break him down.
And let me tell you, looking at the weigh-in pictures, Vera looked good. He looked good and solid at 170. He weighed 172 or 171 and a half or something, but he looked good and solid. Chavez at 173, look at 172.4, looked a little gaunt. You know what I mean? So I honestly think Chavez is going to go up to close to 190. There was a picture floating around of Chavez at one of his brother's fights, and he was in a ring with a T-shirt on, and he easily, and I'm 209 pounds, I'm 6'2". Chavez easily looked like he outweighed me by about 5 or 10 pounds. He easily looked 215, and Chavez is 5'11". So and like they were honestly, you know, the guesstimations were 220. I didn't think he was that heavy, but he was easily 215 of girth. So he no longer can make middleweight. There's no way, shape, or form. And obviously he didn't even make super middleweight. So we'll see.
That's something. 173. If he weighed in at 73, I think you're right. He'll come in over 180.
Oh, yeah, I think so.
I think he'll come in over 180, 182. God,
when he was weighing 160 to fight Sergio Martinez and these guys, he was coming in over 180. He was a cruiserweight fighting at middleweight.
He's going to come in 190.
I think
he's
going
to come in around 190, to be honest.
How can you walk around one day and in good shape, and then 20 pounds heavier, 15 pounds. I don't know how the hell they can function at their best at that with that weight gain. I never understood. In the 50s, nobody was allowed. Well, you weighed in that morning, so you didn't have that. You didn't have that chance. But how could you put on 15, 20 pounds? And I don't know. But I'll tell you, if you remember when he fought the middleweight champion, he really didn't go all out because he didn't have confidence when he gained so much. He didn't have confidence that he was going to be able to finish strong against Martinez. And,
exactly.
And all of a sudden, he felt good. He felt better than he thought he was going to feel. But I think if he knew that he was as strong as he was, he would have put pressure on Martinez earlier. I think he would have won that fight.
And you know, one of the rumors coming out of the camp was the fact that he had such a hard time making weight that he was never able to really, at 160, fight with full energy. So they felt at 168 he would actually be stronger and more aggressive and, you know, more sharp and dynamic.
Yeah.
He was wasting himself down, losing a lot of muscle to fight at 160.
And how much actual sparring and training is he doing outside of losing weight? It seems like he's spending most of his time losing weight. What's he doing as far as skill wise? I mean, that's my question.
How much drug work is he doing?
That's a good question.
Hey, Dr. Chris.
He might be doing too much road work at the table.
Hey,
you know?
Dr. Chris, could you explain?
Yeah,
Dr.
go
Chris,
ahead.
Russian is road work.
Could you explain to us, like, the dangers with same-day weigh-ins and why they stopped that and why not go back to at least early morning weigh-ins? Why did they stop same-day weigh-ins, and what was the significance
of that? Well, you know, it was a tradition in New York when Sugar Ray and LaMotta and all these guys, almost all your fights took place in New York. They were all staying in New York. It was a tradition, 50, 60 years old, you know, in the sport. And then they realized they could make a big deal out of the weigh-in and have a big show and all that. So they put it on a day earlier, you know. Well, you see what the weigh-ins now? How many people show up for weigh-ins now?
Right.
So almost half the fight crowd is at the weigh-in. And now it's a big thing, and then everybody gets a chance to blab and make a fool out of themselves, and everybody thinks it's going to be a better fight because they're ready to swing at one another and all that stuff. So it broke down little by little, but you know what? It's all about money, guys, in that sport.
Wow.
It's all about
Absolutely.
Money. And we know, you know that, when they found out they could make more money by having a weigh-in a day early, that's what they did.
Well, Dr. Chris, you being a doctor, what are the repercussions of a fighter continuously adding on that amount of weight in that short of time?
Hey, guys, we have
here's the thing. Your body is full of electrolytes, sodium, potassium, all these electrolytes. And you get an electrolyte imbalance. Some people can handle it. Some people can't. You never know. Now, Ali used to take diuretics before a fight to lose weight. And he, a couple of times, it made him look terrible. He took heavy diuretics before he fought Frazier in Manila.
Oh,
he was loaded with diuretics.
Wow.
He did it. If you just saw him at training camp 2 weeks before he went to Manila, you wouldn't have believed it was the same guy that showed up in the ring the night of the fight. I mean, it was amazing. I said, what the hell did he do? You know, when I went in for my heart operation, they were taking 6 pounds a day off of me with diuretics. 6 pounds a day. I mean, it's so easy to do. They load you up with 60, 70 milligrams of the diuretic, and you're going to go to the bathroom 40 times. And next thing you know, they had me from 208, they took me down to 172 in a matter of 2 weeks. I mean, that's all with diuretics. But then they give you potassium in a tablet form. They give you all your diuretics back in tablet form and medicine. So, you know, they put them back in you in one day. But I'm wondering, does your body put them in the right spots? You know, does it put everything where it belongs? And are you going to function good, you know, with a load of electrolytes the last day? I don't know. And I don't think anybody could tell you the answer to that.
We have a guy on the line here that can answer that question.
Go ahead. Let's hear it.
Now, let's face it. Water weighs 9 pounds a gallon, so you can use a diuretic to get rid of a lot of weight. There's 3,500 calories to the pound of body weight. So to lose 2 pounds, you got to knock off 7,000 calories, either decrease intake or burn up an extra 7,000. So you know that these guys are just dehydrating themselves.
Right,
and the danger
of
dehydration is organ failure, muscle failure, and a host of other problems.
Right.
And these guys are, in the long run, are not doing themselves any good. And in fact, some of the muscle fibers will break down and be replaced by fat. So a very dangerous situation.
Hey, Frank, where did you find this guy?
Hey, he's standing on the corner.
Where are they? In a holding shop somewhere?
I don't know what Dr. Chris has against anybody from Chester, but let him talk.
He came out of nowhere. Yeah, holy Christ, I thought he was dead. Hey. Hey, how you doing, man? I haven't talked to you for a long while.
I know. Well, you know, I'm on a campaign to ban boxing because I'm tired of all these punch-drunk fighters, all these concussions, getting hit in the head all the time. These rotational injuries to the skull, I'm for banning this word.
Well, what happened to me, I got my nose got about 20 concussions. It didn't go to my brain at all. That giant nose is out there a little too far. You know, that was a hell of a target. What the hell are you going to do about football? Look at football. Jesus Christ, talking about boxing. Boxing's mild compared to football.
Well, I know a guy that coaches a team that won by more than 35 points over the opponent. Eric Holder says that's bullying. So this guy's in trouble. I know he's in trouble.
You're right. You're goddamn right.
You know,
we had 35 points in the first quarter, sir. Thank you very much.
What's that, Notre Dame?
No, Mike.
No,
my,
this is the Pee Wee League. This is the Blue
actually,
Bonnets or something.
No.
Oh.
This is the Storm. My,
I didn't hear
that was
sports.
Yeah, my Pee Wee team had a 35. Well, we ended up 46 to nothing, but it was a running clock. After you get 28, you have to have a running clock in Pop Warner.
Right. Those kids are funny. I never laughed so hard in my life. My grandson's playing in the 70-pound league, and there's actually midgets out there. There's a guy 3 foot tall.
Yep.
The mothers and fathers want their sons to start so early, they're getting them out of kindergarten. I swear to God. I swear to God. You'd die laughing if you go to one of his games.
Oh, my God.
And they stand up and bump one another. They bump into one another, and they push each other. And the ball carrier runs by them, but they're having a good time pushing the other kid. The other kid's pushing them. They don't know where the hell the ball carrier is. Oh, my God. I leave him home. Let him play in the woods or something. Do something. I told Lance, give him a break.
So those kids can't even get their helmets up off the ground once they're hit. We have to turn around and run out and get them up. But it's fun.
Well, look, we're gonna have Tex Cobb tested.
There you go.
We're gonna shoot Ronnie's theory all to hell.
Yeah, ship that brain down to me. Let me look at it.
Tex is ready for Harvard. Tex is ready for Harvard. Don't forget he graduated Temple after his boxing career. You know what his major was? Theology.
That.
Religion.
Wow.
So a guy challenges him, an atheist challenges him, Tex gets up in the classroom and goes after the guy. The guy ran out the door. Tex chased him down the street. I was scared to death. They were in class, and they took the hell off. I died laughing when he told me that story. Oh,
is that Temple O?
Temple O.
Temple O.
Yeah, remember Temple O? That was.
Every time
Temple
I'm with
O.
you, you said you graduated from Temple. The guy would go, "Oh."
Oh. Didn't carry much weight. That was Mel Levy, right? Remember Mel Levy told that?
That's right.
These guys who graduate from Penn, where'd you graduate from? Temple. And they go, oh.
Oh.
Yeah, that's what they told.
Wow.
That's when I told them the joke about my grandfather going to the University of Penn, that he had a second grade education in Italy, and he used to sell beer in wagons and drive it all over, and some very highly educated guy out in the country was impressed with him and gave him a teaching position at the University of Pennsylvania. Do you remember me saying that?
Yep.
And Mel goes, well, what did he teach? I said, he taught broken English. He had the best course in broken English at the university. I got him on that one, and he died after that one. He goes, well, that's the best course in broken English. What the hell? Oh, Christ.
Hey, Chris, I got to go. I just want to call and see if I say hello to you. There's a great Italian restaurant down here now run by the mafia. In fact, if you order the chicken legs, they all come out broken.
Don't bitch about the menu.
Oh, my God.
I'll use that.
I don't want to go there and bitch about it. My wife will go there and shoot her. She starts bitching about everything. Hey.
Oh, wow.
Hey, Ron, good talking to you. Well, I've been to call you about 100 times.
I know.
A lot going on.
I know. I hear you.
You hear me?
All right.
You told me you're going back to work. Is that true?
I am. I have a new. Yeah, for 3 months now.
Wow.
Body sculpting.
How are you holding up?
Oh, great. Hey, I'm sculpting bodies. I'm making women beautiful.
Oh, Christ.
Hey, I used to be a pocket fitter in a woman's sweater factory. You know, they didn't want the pockets. I used to rub them off.
Frank, I'll catch up with you later.
Buddy. Take care, buddy.
All right. See ya. Bye.
Z, I've been trying to get a hold of a good friend of mine, Edna Cherry, for you.
Hey.
And I'm going to see, I'm going to keep trying, but his phone keeps going to service. But Edna did buy himself out of his contract with the guys in Chicago and has got a fight coming up in October, which we're going to go over to. My grandson and I are going to go over to, and we're trying to make sure that it's we're going to either tape it or we're going to do it live. So,
Butch, real quick, do you know who he signed with?
No, he hasn't. He went back to Winky Wright.
Okay.
To work for management. Winky's got his own team together now, and I'm not sure who the promoter is with him, but he's working out of Winky's gym now. But,
hey, coming back to this weight gain, I meant to tell you guys, the most important thing, Ronnie will tell you this, is body fat. If your body fat goes down too low, that's the dangerous thing. Your body fat, you can cramp up. Women, if their body fat drops below, like, say, 13 or 14%, they stop menstruating. Young girls that work out. And I remember Johnny Bumpus. He was a pretty tall guy, and he couldn't make 139 anymore. And Vic Papo from the gym, from Upper Darby, was fighting him, and his legs cramped up, almost had to stop the fight. I mean, he you know, that was the reason his body fat was too damn low. And I often wondered how that big, tall kid, that welterweight that was in the Olympics that nobody could beat because, Christ, he was 6'2 at 147. You know who I'm speaking of?
How
long
ago?
He did become, 15 years ago.
Mark Breland.
Yeah. How
Mark
the hell Breland. Did he not? What do you think his body fat was? It looked like it was zero.
Yeah.
I mean, he made it through. That's why I said sometimes one guy can handle it. One guy can't, but Ronnie's up on all that because he did a lot of work with trainers and physical therapy and rehabilitation. He whatever he said, you know, probably was correct, 100% correct. It's going to catch up with you after. Well, I caught up with Ali, but was it old age that caught up with him, or was it the constant use of diuretics? I don't know.
To be honest, I've been watching a lot of Ali. They've been having a lot of Ali on demand, and I've been watching a lot of his fights. I think it was a lot of the clowning. I think Ali had so much confidence in his chin and that he could do that. When he fought Ronnie Lyle, he said he would do the rope-a-dope. You know, after he fought George Foreman, he said he would do the rope-a-dope. And when Howard Cosell asked him, what if Ronnie Lyle doesn't fall for it? Ali said, well, I'm going to go up, I'm going to put my guard up and just walk up to him. And he said he might win the first few rounds, but then I'll figure him out. And then, you know how Ali gets. He started rhyming and saying when he'll do it.
I think a big part of that, too, was when his skills diminished, his hand and foot speed, especially coming back from the layoff, he was a special type of fighter where he could really, you know, outlast people because he was so durable too. And that's the thing that gets taken for credit. He could not only could he take a punch, but he was so durable. So I think, you know, for him it made sense to walk into the eye of the hurricane and let this guy spend his load because Ali knew that he was more durable than the average guy. That was the other thing he had too. And he also had tremendous wit and straight punches, very straight punches when he let him go.
Yeah, and, but within that durability, that was his clowning. I mean, he knew he could take a punch. Ali would put his hands down, see a punch coming, and rather than move his head, I mean, he would just turn his chin a little bit, say, I could take it, and then I'll reset myself, I'll keep my feet moving. He did it when he was young. When he was older, and, you know, basically after that three-year layoff, when he got older, he was a little more, his feet were more planted. So he couldn't roll with the punch with his feet as much. You know, he could lean back, roll with a punch when he was younger with his feet and had to take a lot of the steam off the punch. So when he was older, he knew it could take a solid punch, and that's when that damage started coming in. And he still had that clowning mentality with it. Like, he would still take the punch. Like, against Ken Norton, he would take a punch thinking that he would get a counter off, thinking he would get one of the wide, quick right counters off that Ali gets. And it didn't work out. I mean, this is that kind of mentality.
I think taking punches, being able to take a punch, his durability got to be an enemy, his worst enemy. Because
yep.
I watched him against Ken Norton in New York at Yankee Stadium. And Norton was a big man and strong. And he banged him in the body, in the jaw. And it had no effect on Ali. How the hell is it not affecting him? I mean, he's getting hit hard. You're right there. You can see it. Well, that was the first fight, and that was the upper jaw.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, the upper jaw is softer than the lower jaw. The mandible is the hardest bone in the body. The shins, your shins and the mandible are the two hardest bones in the body. The maxilla is very soft. So he broke along the tooth line. You know, he broke his upper jaw, which that's pretty common in the game, you know, to get a tooth loose. So they say, oh, he broke his jaw. But Christ, it heals in 3 weeks. You don't. When you wire a maxilla, when you're doing jaw work and somebody got a broken jaw, maxilla in 2 weeks, you could take the wires off and let them start eating again. It's still got so much blood supply, but the mandible is so damn dense, it doesn't have good blood supply, and it takes three times longer to heal. So, I mean, I set fractured jaws. I did hundreds of them in the Army and at Chester Hospital and all that. And the maxilla, I mean, it sets so fast, the upper jaw, it sets very fast. That's what Norton broke on Ali, the maxilla, you know. But nobody ever broke his chin, his lower jaw, nobody. I mean, he just, when we were at training camp, when he was getting ready for that fight in Manila, he didn't block punches. He just laid there, and Rodney Bobick, who was a big guy, was bopping him on a damn chin, and it wasn't phasing. I mean, it didn't have any effect on him. I mean, he was a great. He never got credit for it, maybe full credit. But he was one of the great punch takers of all times.
Oh my God!
He had a great chin.
Yeah.
He had a great chin. I mean, maybe the only guy that had a better chin than him might have been Tex Cobb. I mean.
Oh yeah.
Tex never was floored, and he got hit by school buses and didn't get hurt. He walked across a road in Canada to go get something to drink, and a truck hit him. And the radiator. Tex became part of the radiator. He bounced off the radiator. A big truck hit him. Jesus Christ. And you know, it didn't knock him out. Knocked him down and across the street. He got the hell up. He said, the bumper missed me, but the radiator got me. But he was a normal guy. He was immune. He was immune to pain. I mean, Larry Holmes, that Larry Holmes fight still, it's like a horror movie watching poor Tex get hit 10,000 times. Right? A right flush on the chin. And when Holmes was down on his feet and was set, he could hit pretty damn hard.
Yeah.
Holmes could hit pretty hard when he sat down. When he was jabbing and moving around the ring, he was a different type of fight. But when he sat down, he could unload.
The confidence,
man.
He had that confidence when he knew what to do.
What are some of the things, Dr. Chris, a guy could do? How could you train a fighter to increase his punch resistance?
I think it's all mental.
Yeah.
I think it's between the ears. You know, if you have no fear and you say, I can't be knocked out, you go in that ring with that attitude, you can take a punch. If you're afraid, you're going to get knocked the hell out. I mean, I think it's all mental, taking a punch. I don't think there's any way you can train a human brain to take a punch. I don't think it can be done. I think it's all mental. If you think you're the toughest guy in the world, you know, maybe you are. You know, nobody can hurt me, and you go in there with that attitude, then you'll take a punch. If not, you know, you've got a hell of a problem. I know in early years they used to think if you got hit on the chin, it sent a message to the brain. That's how you got knocked out. So they gave guys Novocaine shots. They numbed the jawbone both sides.
Right.
It didn't help.
It doesn't help. You get knocked out anyway. When you get knocked out.
Yeah, right. What the hell does the jaw have to do? The pain is from the brain. Knockout comes from the brain, not the jaw. But they actually used to numb guys up.
Like when Pacquiao got knocked out. He ran into a crushing punch. Is there just nothing a guy can do about that?
He was walking. Well, it hurts twice as bad when you're walking in. When you're backing up, it doesn't hurt. But when you're walking in, boom, I mean, you feel that punch it hurts. You know, if you don't get knocked out, you get the flash. You see the flash. Flash goes right up. The fighters call it a flash. God damn, he flashed me. And then you're moving in and you get hit, boom, it hurts twice as much. And that's why I don't understand how Tex took the fight. He got caught moving in all the time.
He never was going backwards.
Jesus Christ. And, you know, I watch him closely to see if he's having any effects from all that. And to be honest with you, I don't see any effects. His wife's got him running. He's down to 208, 210 pounds.
Oh, wow.
He moves around a ring now like a light heavy. You wouldn't believe it how he moves now.
Wow.
She got him jogging every day, and he doesn't eat all that crap. I don't see the effects of it. I mean, he talks okay, his memory's okay, you know, and all that. I mean, I don't see any effects, but, you know, that's what I can't say about, you know, about everybody, but, like, you know, but I remember the old fighters coming in.
Well, Dr. Chris, the best chins in history, what I say, when they get hit, it doesn't react throughout the body. Like, what I'm trying to say is the knees don't wobble. You know, you don't see any reactions through the body. Like, Evander Holyfield, I want to give him one good example. The only time I've seen him wobbled a couple times by Burt Cooper and by Riddick Bell. And those guys hit him sharp. But I think he has one of the best chins in history also.
He did. And Burt's
was also
pretty
moving
good,
up
to fight
bigger guys, too. He was taking those shots from bigger guys.
Exactly.
You got to give him a good chin. You know, give credit for a good chin. Marciano had a good chin. He was only down about two times in his life, two or three times in his life. He had a good
Walcott
chin.
Walcott and Lewis.
Lewis had a fair chin. Walcott had a better one. Walcott had a lot of fights where you know he didn't. The only time I ever saw him get knocked out, really, like that was against Marciano.
Right. And he put Marciano
down
in the fight.
Yeah, Walcott fought in Marcus Hook, Pennsylvania for my father when he was promoting fights as a welterweight, like about 150 pounds. He was very, very young, and then he blossomed into a heavyweight. He got bigger and bigger and bigger. And here's a guy that packed on weight. He's a powerful man, Joe Walcott.
Yeah.
He hit pretty damn hard. That left hook he hit Charles with was as good a punch as I ever saw in ring history. I mean, he staggered. He knocked Charles cold, and nobody knocked Charles out but one shot. And
Tex would go down as having one of the greatest chins in history, obviously.
Who's that?
Tex Cobb.
Tex
definitely
Cobb.
One of the greatest chins in history. You know,
for
my money, since Tex Cobb, since Tex, the guy with the best chin I've seen was Antonio Margarito. I've never seen a guy
with
shots like that and not
modern fighters. Yeah, he used to get his face punched in, didn't have any effect on him.
No, I mean,
you know?
Even the term, yeah, that was something different.
I mean,
I
used to think the same thing, yeah.
Well, that was part of Margarito's game plan.
Yeah.
Part of Margarito's game plan was to get punched in the face.
Shit, if he could tire you out by letting you hit him in the face.
And while
yeah.
you hit him in the face, he's punching you in the body.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah,
that's
true. He didn't last long.
Mm-mm.
LaMotta had a good shit. I have to give credit. I got to say LaMotta had a good shit.
Excellent
shit. He had a great chin. He never, you know. I saw him get, he was off balance one time against when he was getting older.
Why,
I fought a guy named Nick Barone.
Who was that?
A big muscular light heavyweight.
Okay.
And LaMotta couldn't make
160
anymore.
Oh, yeah, I remember that, yeah.
Jake LaMotta, and he was off balance, and it was the way that Barone moved away, and he threw a left hand at the same time, and Jake was trying to turn around, and he was on 1 foot, and he slipped to one knee, but he was up at the count. I mean, he was up to count one. He was ref didn't even get a chance to count, but they made him take a count. But he was down for maybe a tenth of a second at best.
Was that the only time he was off his feet?
I saw one time in his life.
And it's funny, Marvin Hagler
knockdown.
Yeah, Marvin Hagler was only down once in his life, and that was against Rodon. And if you look at the tape, it was a slip, and it was the one time he got called for a knockdown.
Hagler had a great chin.
That reminds me, Dr. Chris, I asked you a question a while ago about a fight between Sugar Ray Robinson and Marvin Hagler. How do you think that would go?
Well, that's a tough one. You know, I'm going to say it. Here's what I believe. Hagler was a full-grown middleweight. He had the body of a middleweight. And he was strong. He was fast. He could do it all. Sugar Ray was a lower weight. He didn't have the bone structure that Hagler. Hagler was a stronger man than Sugar Ray.
Agreed.
And Sugar Ray was one of the few guys I ever saw that could back up, set his front foot down, and swing the left hook and knock out a bull. He knocked Gene Fulmer out with a left hook.
Yeah.
Moving backwards.
Okay.
Yeah. For a split second, he put his left foot down. And Gene Fulmer had a head like a Neanderthal man. He looked like a caveman.
He did.
Jesus Christ, I saw him. His forehead got to be 3 inches thick. I mean, I met him, and his hands are huge. And I'm thinking, the whole time I'm talking to him, I'm thinking, Sugar Ray, how the hell did you knock this guy out? How the hell did you ever knock Gene Fulmer out? It was the first time he'd ever been knocked down when Sugar Ray knocked him out. Yeah. Sugar Ray, I'm giving an example of how hard Sugar Ray hit with his left hook. And Hagler was just, Hagler could box beautifully. I saw him against Benny Briscoe lose a round. I mean, he just fought. He could really box. He'd have to pressure, being a shorter guy by 3 or 4 inches, he'd have to put the pressure on Sugar Ray. And Sugar Ray fought great backing up. He fought great backing up. I don't know. If I had to bet my life on it, I'd bet on Sugar Ray. You know? I bet on Sugar Ray. But I really like Marvin Hagler. Oof. Every time I see that fight against that big guy he fought, was a big middleweight. He took a lot out of Hagler. Hagler took those punches from him. I think the guy was from Africa.
John Mugabe.
He was a beast. John Mugabe was one hell of a fighter. And boy, did he test Hagler's chin out that night? Woo. Hagler never was the same after that fight. He didn't. That was a tough fight for him.
Sugar Ray Leonard said it was that fight that made him realize that he thought he could beat the Hagler was past his prime, and he thought he could beat Hagler. He said when he saw Mugabe give Hagler that fight, he said, I can beat him.
I thought that's where Hagler started to lose a little bit against Mugabe. But he did have a chin. My old trainer was in Las Vegas when Hagler was training for the and he was, being from Boston, he was friends with the Petronelli brothers. And Zeke called me on the phone. He said, "You're not going to believe this. They're trying to get Hagler down to 156 to increase his speed. Instead of letting him come in the ring at a full 160 and bull Sugar Ray around, they were training him and working him out extra during the night with sweat clothes on to keep his weight at 156. So that they didn't want him to enter the ring, you know, at one, you know, like they weighed in that morning, he would have come in pretty heavy, but they made him keep his weight down. They thought that speed would help him beat Sugar Ray, and was the wrong thing, because what would have beat Sugar Ray would have been a good, strong Marvin Hagler. I don't think Sugar Ray would have won that fight.
I think the game plan had a lot to do with that.
It was based on that. I think he was part of it, obviously.
Hagler still, he might have lost something, but he was still in good enough shape. And I actually think he won the fight.
A lot of people still think Hagler won the fight anyway, so.
Yeah, that's true. Well, you know, that ring, the night they fought, the bad thing about that was the Petronelli brothers agreed to a 15-foot ring, which gave Sugar Ray room to move around and keep the hell away from Hagler. That's the biggest the ring could be is 15-foot, and he signed a contract for a 15-foot ring. I think that was his biggest mistake. I mean, you know, Sugar Ray could sure in hell move backwards much faster than Hagler, you know.
But I think Hagler was in better shape than Sugar Ray, and the fight wound down around like the fifth round, around the fifth round, Sugar Ray stopped moving his feet.
Well, remember Hagler came out orthodox too for some strange reason.
He came out orthodox trying to box with Sugar Ray. As I say, the game plan had more than anything to do with that.
That's exactly right. The Petronelli brothers had a bad game plan for Marvin Hagler.
Yeah.
If they'd have left him going back to Boston a month earlier, Hagler would have had his own game plan. And it would have been to go in and just walk right the hell through Sugar Ray, which he would have done if he came in at a good, strong weight and didn't try to, you know, outbox him, so to speak, and get down to 156. 4 pounds, 5 pounds is critical for a guy like Hagler. Christ, he was all muscle. Where the hell was he going to lose weight?
They
probably took muscle off of him.
Absolutely.
And he was one of my favorite fighters. And I told LaMotta that. LaMotta said, "I didn't beat him." I said, "Jake, Hagler would have given you all you wanted." I said, "He's been dancing around you, tattooing your face." He said, "I'll come out of this booth and kick your ass." I said, "Come on." He was about 8 years old.
You think LaMotta would have been Hagler would have been a real bad matchup for LaMotta?
I think Hagler would outbox LaMotta.
I do.
I think he would have beat LaMotta
with extreme power.
The way he moved right and left, it could go from right hand to left hand, and LaMotta would have never touched him. He'd have LaMotta going in circles.
You think he could have stopped LaMotta?
I don't think so. I saw him fight. You know, he fought Bob Satterfield, the hardest punching heavyweight in the world. And Jake fought him in Detroit. Jake came in about 67, and Satterfield came in about 185. You know, Jake knocked him the hell out. Satterfield couldn't believe it. I hit him right on the chin, didn't have any effect. He knocked all these heavyweights out and couldn't knock LaMotta out. So I know Hagler didn't hit that hard as Satterfield, but... Jake fought a lot. See, Jake was his own manager. He never signed with anybody.
Right.
And that's why he fought in Detroit. He could only get fights in the toughest towns and fight the toughest fighters.
So he had to fight a lot of other fights.
Yeah, that's where he fought Sugar Ray. When he beat Sugar Ray, he fought Sugar Ray in Detroit. And Sugar Ray was screwing around. I read in his life story, he said, when I got up in the ring and I looked over at his oak body, he called it oak, he said, "I knew I was in trouble because I wasn't trained." He said, "I didn't train good." And he said, "He gave me a body beating." He said, "He knocked me the hell down with a left hook to the body." He said, "I knew I was in trouble." That's the first time LaMotta ever beat him.
Right. Well, the only time, yeah.
The only time. They came close, but... Lamada, like I said, I don't think Hagler would have knocked him out. I don't think, and Jake never cut. Jake didn't cut that day. He never cut.
Ah, so he wouldn't have to worry about that. Yeah.
No, I don't think. Yeah, I think Lamada, Hagler would have beat him by outboxing. I guarantee you, he would have beat. I would bet everything on Hagler on that fight.
You don't think Lamada's pressure would have been able enough to deter Hagler?
Benny Brusco was as hard a puncher in the middleweight division ever had. He could hit like a mule. Hagler moved backwards, and just when he was moving backwards, jabbing with the left hand, okay? And just when Brusco cut the ring off and thought he had him, Hagler would turn around and jab with the right hand and move right around Brusco. And have him turn around and put five shots on his face. Remember? He just could not corner Hagler.
His straight shot.
He tried.
And Hagler would switch up, orthodox, and he'd go straight shots on him.
Yeah, all right. There was another middleweight that would have gave anybody a tough fight. Would have been Carlos Monzon.
Oh my God,
yeah.
He was difficult to fight. Ah,
he had a long reach. Carlos Monzon had a long reach. Yeah,
he was 6 foot tall when you weighed in, and when he fought, you weighed in that morning. He didn't come in at 175 pounds. He was a legitimate middleweight. Nino Benvenuti. Yeah, he was strong, and he had a good uppercut. He pushed it down. He got near him, he pushed it down. He fought. He reminded me when Frazier went into Foreman, Foreman just pushed on him, pushed him down, kept him low, wouldn't let him get off. That's what Monzon did with everybody. They charged into him, he hit you with an uppercut, and then pushed it down. You couldn't do a damn thing. Big, strong guy. Now, he fought how many title fights did he have where he never lost? He retired undefeated, didn't he?
Yep.
Benny Brusco did not do very well against Monzon. Monzon had 6 inches in height on him, and Benny didn't do well. And matter of fact, nobody did any good against him. The only guy that did any good against him was Benvenuti because he was 6 foot tall. They fought for the title, but Monzon took the title from Benvenuti. And Nino Benvenuti, yeah, him and Emil Griffith had a great fight.
Right.
They had a great fight. Emil Griffith was a tough guy. You know, but anyway, there's another. I mean, there was great middleweights. I think Monzon would have definitely would have beat Lamada. He would have outboxed Lamada, and almost anybody. I don't know who the hell could out you know with that long reach he had. And how strong he was. I often wonder what the hell scale does he get on to weigh 160.
He was a big one. I mean, he was a big boy.
Yeah, big shoulders.
I looked at him. Well, he weighed 160 pounds.
Yeah. How do you think he would have done against some of the slicker boxing middleweights like the Bernard Hopkins or the
Michael Nunn.
Ray Robinson, Michael Nunn, some of those guys?
Michael Nunn he would have beat. Sugar Ray, like I say, he moved up from the welterweight to the middleweight, and he wasn't a real strong middleweight, good hard punching middleweight, but it would have been interesting because it would have been one of the few times that Sugar Ray didn't have the reach on the other guy.
Right.
You know, and I often thought about that. Who the hell would win if him and Sugar Ray fought?
Then again, you know what? It'd be interesting to see. Because even though he was 6 foot and Sugar Ray was 5'11", I wouldn't be surprised if Sugar Ray still had a longer reach than Monzon. I wouldn't be surprised if you looked that up and he had a slightly longer reach than Monzon.
Well, Sugar Ray would have got there first.
Yeah,
he had narrower shoulders. His shoulders weren't real wide.
Oh,
he had narrower shoulders.
Dr. Chris.
Monzon had great big wide shoulders.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah. You're right.
Oh,
you're right.
Yeah.
You're right.
You know, and if you look that up, you're going to see that he had bigger reach than.
Yeah, no, you're right.
Bigger reach.
Yeah, the shoulders.
Shoulders were
bigger.
Sugar Ray was
absolutely right.
He had shoulders like Tyson. You ever see Tyson in person when he was in shape? He had round shoulders. And he had sloping trapezius muscles.
Yeah, you're right.
They sloped right into his.
Compact. He was compact.
Compact, yeah, with sloped shoulders. He didn't have big shoulders. And my son, he walks by my son. My son says, He knew bigger than me. I'm as big as he is. I said, would you like to fight him? He goes, hell no. I'm like, what the hell difference does it make? what son is he?
Sounds like my son.
That bothers me when guys say that. He ain't no bigger than me. He'd kick your butt all over town, you know what I mean? What the hell difference does it make? A lot of guys assume because they're taller than you they can beat you. That's so wrong.
Mm-hmm.
It's so wrong. But a lot of guys, they place they think weight height has a lot of influence. It doesn't.
No.
It doesn't. At a certain point, it doesn't. I know that was the night that when we were down there, Tyson walked by us. He was there for the Bobby Chiss fight. Chiss was fighting Marty Feldman's fighter, Williams. And that guy, that big gang leader in New York, Mitch. Remember Mitch?
Mitch Black Green.
He caused a big scene in there. He was yelling and screaming, I want Mike out. He was yelling, and Trump let him sound off for about a half an hour. And then Trump pointed a group over there, and about 60 of the biggest guys you ever want to see converged on him. And he got the hell out of there. He backed up. He goes, okay. He put his hands up. He goes, I'm leaving. It looked like a 40 NFL linemen coming after him, you know. He got the hell out of there. I saw him close enough to see that big gash Mike put in his forehead. Mike hit him with a left hook with a ring on. And you can see the gash right down the middle of his forehead, right between the eyes.
Jeez.
Why the hell would you want to pick a street fight with Mike Tyson? In his prime. That wasn't too smart.
No.
But,
I don't guys think it's a fight with him now, either. Yeah. I don't think it'd be too smart to pick a fight with him now.
But you know what? Him and Holyfield were on the other night together. Did you see it?
No.
They had an interview with Holyfield and him together. They're buddies. They were laughing.
Yeah.
They were laughing. Tyson was talking about biting his ear, and he said, man, you jumped up with a white crane. He said, you jumped up in the air about 2 feet when I bit your ear. And Holyfield was laughing, and they were having a good time. You know, they had no remorse towards each other. They were laughing. And,
hey, Dr. Chris.
You could see Holyfield there.
Hey, Dr. Chris, Vito has always had an issue with Mills Lane in that fight. Vito's always had a big issue with Mills Lane in that fight. Because
you're talking about the ear biting?
Yeah.
Now, here's my issue. All right. Mike Tyson didn't know they fought, and if, I guess Evander Holyfield butted. Mike Tyson bit the ear. He bit the ear the one time. All right.
Yeah.
Lil Zane stops the fight. He takes a point. All right. He takes a point for biting the ear. Then the fight continues. He bites another ear. He takes another point. And then the first round stops. And after the first round, they stopped the fight. My whole issue is, why didn't they stop the fight after the first ear biting?
I don't know. I think
it was almost like
everybody.
Mills Lane didn't know what to do.
Is it legal?
I think for once, Mills Lane didn't know what to do. He was like, what should I do? Do I stop the fight? You know, what do I do?
He bit
the man's ear. I mean, do you let it continue?
He took his mouthpiece out to bite him too.
That's the whole
bit the ear
thing.
Off.
Both
bit
times
off.
You bit the mouthpiece
a part
out.
Of it off.
You bit the mouthpiece out and bit a part of a man's body off.
And the fight was allowed to continue after that.
is it still sanctioned?
That's because it was the ear. Didn't make any difference. If the ear bleeds, you still see good. So it probably didn't put a lot of weight on biking.
As long as the fight continues.
Early in the century, the fighters used to all bite each other. They didn't even wear a mouthpiece. They used to bite, and that became one of the Marquess of Queensberry rules was no more biting. Everybody bit. So, if you bit the ear, I guess if you bit his nose, he probably would have disqualified him right on the spot. But he already bit his ear. Figure you can still fight with the ear. You know?
Wow.
I guess
guys, we're right up on the clock here.
And we had a good time tonight, guys.
Yes,
oh, my God.
We did.
A lot of fun.
Show.
Oh, my boy.
A lot of fun. I hope the public enjoys it as much as we did.
Oh, yeah. My God, Jeff.
All right, guys. See you next week.
Okay,
bye.
Thanks,
Chris. See you next week, Dr. Chris. Thanks.
See you, guys. Bye.
All right, Z, you want to lead us out?
Yes, I do. I want to thank our two esteemed doctors. Thank you for their information. I want to thank you guys. Love being on here with you. This show was fun. These shows are definitely in memory of Bob. And if anyone wants to hear any fighting words, please do call. Doc.
Hey, I want to thank everyone that was on the air, our two esteemed doctors. Dr. Chris, who I almost halfway expect to jump in right now with an Eagles bash like he did last week. Okay, he didn't. So with
yeah,
that
didn't.
Being said, Bob is our co-policy. Everyone next week.
All right, I want to thank everybody for being on tonight. It was really a lot of fun tonight. You guys always are at the top of your game, and those two guys were right at the top of their game. What was really nice is when we got into the weight thing that Dr. Repesee was able to talk about that, because he has been in the weight game for a long, long time. Ladies and gentlemen, these programs are brought to you each and every night, 7 nights a week, in grateful appreciation of the men and women of the United States Armed Forces, men and women of Police and Fire Services. These programs are also dedicated to officers who have lost their lives. Deputy Robert Anthony Carroll, Patrolman David Curtis, Patrolman Jeffrey Colcap, Sergeant Thomas Batinger, Patrolman Jeffrey Yazwitz, Patrolman David Crawford, Detective Randy Bell, Detective Ricky Childers, San Diego Officer Mike Hendler, Lieutenant Mike Zerba, Newcastle County Police, Patrolman Arnolfo Crispin, Lakeland PD, Deputy Barbara Pell, Broward County Sheriff's Office, Chief Al Hogel, Longboat Key Police Department, Chief Jimmy Ford, Wilmington Fire Department, Highway Patrolman Brian Lazaro, Philadelphia Highway Patrol, Patrolman Alonzo Moses, Philadelphia Uniform Division, Patrolman Brian Murphy, Plymouth Township PD, Lieutenant Bob Neary, Philadelphia Fire Department, Assistant Chief Michael Godwin, Philadelphia Fire Department, MIT Officer Sean Collier, and Sergeant Mike Wilson, Charlotte County Sheriff's Office. My brothers and sisters, although you may be 10-7 at this time, at some time we'll be 10-10 at the table of the Lord. Until that day, may the rose rise up to meet you. May the winds be always at your back. May the sun shine softly on your face and the rains fall softly on your field. Until we meet again, may the good Lord keep you and your families always in the hallow of their hands. Good night.
Shem alekma yelama, Shem ahezah yelama, Son Hashem nevorat fes, Hakuig again ma yelama. Oh,
County Dispatch in 1999. County Dispatch in 1999. All units be advised, 1999 has responded to his last emergency. May God rest his soul.